I'm not sure how many letters, but this only works if you pronounce it the correct way. Niches in pieces. No, it's got to rhyme with quiche, not kitsch. Okay, so I think a question that's really interested me ever since I was an undergraduate is trying to understand why a continuous distribution of resources should get split up, so why nature should proliferate into lots of different niches and generate biodiversity. I think a nice point that Jim made yesterday was pointing out that we actually shouldn't think that, you know, virtually all lineages don't do this. We observe the ones that do because they proliferate and form many species, but many, many examples of lineages don't undergo any adaptive radiation at all, or hardly any over the timescales we can observe. I think the things that are really important for causing ecological diversification, as Bob was talking about yesterday as well, is this idea of trade-offs, both in terms of ecological niches, in terms of trade-offs in how the different resources one can use, but also genetic trade-offs. So I think I want to try and convince you that the details of the genetics are actually quite important, and we need to know a lot more about the genetics of traits if we want to try and answer this question. Basically, we're talking about how alleles get associated with particular environments, and from the point of view of speciation, how alleles become associated together, so selection's acting on genotypes rather than just on allele frequencies. And that distinction, I think, is the key to understanding speciation. It doesn't mean that I understand it, but it's the key to it. And the way that I try and think about it is a very simple way, which is basically trying to understand why adaptation stops along some kind of gradient in space which affects fitness. And these models are kind of very closely related to Bob Holt's models and the kind of ideas of evolutionary rescue when you move into a new habitat, but they're different in that they're continuous, in that they assume you have a population that starts off in a particular place in space and tries to adapt to some change in the environment in space by evolving a divergent phenotype at different points. And we can ask under what circumstances populations are able to match the gradient the whole length and get an unlimited distribution, so get effectively an infinitely large species range, or under what circumstances they only adapt to a tiny proportion of the gradient and you have a kind of areas where there's no adaptation or where there's marginal populations aren't very well adapted, so they have low density. So this kind of assumes one of the key assumptions here is that stabilizing selection is operating, so that if you're far from the optimum at a particular point in space, your fitness is lower and you have a concomitant reduction in population density at the edge. So these are called dermogenetic models. They couple population genetics with population ecology. And I kind of quite like them because when you think about this situation, which is what all of nature has, you end up with limited ranges and basically you end up with beta diversity. So you end up with the evolution of power patry. Different populations, different species or different populations will replace each other along this gradient. So this kind of asks the question, why does adaptation stop at ecological margins? And we can clearly think that gene flow along these gradients can mean that it's hard to actually match your local optimum and you get reductions in fitness because of bringing in badly adapted alleles. And this follows on from theory that everyone's favourite man of action, J.B.S. Haldane, developed in the 50s in his theory of the Klein, and he basically characterises two types of load that are caused by gene flow. Is the kind of swamping effects of movement along a gradient. And one is you have this generation of standing load, so even if you match the optimum, there's variance around that phenotypic, around your phenotype, only some of your individuals are at the optimum. So this standing load means that you can match the optimum but have quite low fitness as a whole population. And where you don't match the optimum, where there's a tail, where you're off the optimum at the edge of the range, there's what's called a lag load, which is this cost because the mean doesn't match the optimum. So there's these two components of load. And Kirkpatrick and Barton did quite a nice model in 97, which I'm sure many of us are familiar with, which people got quite excited by, you know, in a sort of local sort of a way. They got very excited by the fact that this seemed to explain, putting these models into an analytical framework, seemed to explain to some degree why limited ranges exist. So if you characterise the behaviour of models with various different parameter values, and you compare additive genetic variance in fitness with the rate of change in selection, so how fast selection changes in space, from the perspective of the organisms, you find that it does seem that there's this kind of relationship between how much variance you have in fitness, the additive variance in fitness, as Fisher predicted, and how much selection changes, so how steep your gradients are, effectively. So if you have a lot of genetic variance, you can adapt, have an unlimited range in quite high levels of rate of change of selection, but if you have hardly any additive genetic variance, you're stuck, you get limited ranges, species do what we see them doing all the time, which is form little bubbles of distributions on ecological gradients. And you find that this happens when you have low levels of genetic variance. So this was quite nice because it seemed to explain why species have limited ranges, and basically all species in nature must be somewhere within this parameter space. But we don't know anything about what these values are in nature, of course, but I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, this is all very exciting, and then Nick came along and made the model much more comprehensive, much more useful, if you like, and he included this other much-talked-about feature of gene flow, which is that it increases variance. So it allows a faster response to selection because it increases the additive variance. And he allowed the genetic variance to evolve along these gradients. So Kirkpatrick and Barton had assumed a fixed genetic variance, and they changed it with different runs of their model or different analytical predictions. But you have to, if you allow this effect of gene flow increasing additive variation and increasing the response to selection, you find that adaptation is possible at virtually any steepness of gradient. So for a range of plausible genetic, quantitative genetic models, three types of model that he used, he found adaptation is possible to virtually any gradient until you reach some critical limit, which I'll explain in a second. So you're left again with the question, why are all species distributions limited? Why do parapatric distributions form at all along a continuous gradient? So these predictions are quite nice. This Barton model produces some quite nice predictions for the two different types of gene flow, the spreading and the swamping effects of gene flow. And I was helped a lot in this by Yitka Polichova, who works as part of Nick's group. And we can predict the swamping effect of gene flow. This is the sort of thing that Kirkpatrick and Barton were talking about. This should stop when the required trait gradient, which is B, which is equivalent to the steepness of the gradient, how much you have to change your trait to match the gradient. Adaptation should stop when this happens, basically. And so it's related to the amount of genetic variance, additive variance and fitness, related to the strength of stabilizing selection, so how much it costs you to be far from the optimum, and down to your intrinsic rate of growth at the optimum. So this is the point where adaptation should collapse, where the steepness should stop populations being able to spread. Now the problem is, of course, as I've shown, that this VG evolves itself, and that increases in dispersal along the gradient mean that the genetic variance in fitness will increase relative to this equation here. Until you reach this critical limit where the cost of the variance is equal to the maximum population growth rate. So though you can match the optimum, the cost of the standing load, the cost of the variance around the mean is so high that you can match it, but your mean fitness is zero. So it's the cost of the standing load, if you like. So you predict a critical limit, but most of the time you should be able to match any optimum up to some huge amount of gene flow. So of course, any kind of analytical model produces these kind of questions about how relevant it is to the real world. So we wanted to ask, well, do you find this effect of gene flow on variance in real populations, in real traits, in the real world? And how does it affect adaptation in real situations? In particular, given that we know that genetics of fitness traits are very complex, how much does gene flow really increase variance? And what proportion of that variance is due to associations between alleles being generated by gene flow, which is what we call linkage disequilibria. And once you have disequilibria, once you have alleles spreading together, if you like, once they're associated statistically in the population, you can have selection can act to favour certain genotypes, not just changes in allele frequency. And we can ask the question, where in parameter space are real populations at ecological margins? Are they actually at this critical limit, where the thing that's going on is the gene flow is so huge that the population just collapses all the time? So the first thing we did was to transpose those analytical models into individual-based simulations to try and see what the effects of stochasticity and colonization effects were on these types of models, these continuous models that Nick and Yitka had developed. We basically allowed a population to colonize with a particular genetic, quantitative genetic basis. We allowed it to colonize a gradient and see how far it spread. And this is exactly the same sort of model. It's just this is the density-dependent part, and this is the stabilizing selection part, the cost of being far from the optimum relative to the optimum phenotype. And just very briefly, what we found from doing this, from transposing it into a real situation, was that, you know, the analytical models work surprisingly well when you have a very high carrying capacity, when the population size is large. This is the critical limit that this model predicts. in terms of the point where the mean fitness equals the standing load. And we find that adaptation. So these blue pie charts here are where you get unlimited ranges. So this is where you get limited ranges. And we find that, yeah, amazing. When you have a high enough, effectively infinite population, the limit does predict it quite nicely. But as the population size gets smaller, so as you change the carrying capacity of your patches, you find that actually you get adaptation prevented at much lower levels. Okay, so there is a kind of nice relationship to the critical limit. We wanted to ask then how well these actually match the analytical predictions I showed you in those equations. So we find that the density in the gradient, the density of the populations changes as a product of total dispersal. These are the predictions from this variance load, this standing load prediction. And there is indeed a swamping effect. So you do get this kind of collapse in population density up to that critical limit, where the population just suddenly can't adapt anymore because the population fitness is so low relative to the rate of growth. So you get this decline in fitness, even though you're matching the optimum, gene flow is increasing your variance and affecting your mean fitness. What we were kind of more interested in, actually, was how you partition the variance that's caused by gene flow. Because Nick's models kind of assume a linkage equilibria, but when you have individual-based simulations, you start to get associations developing because clines start to overlap. So we're here, this is the segregating variance, which is the variance caused by segregation within loci, so between alleles. We find that, of course, you do get an increase in variance with dispersal. This is the predicted increase here. And this is at different carrying capacities. The carrying capacity makes no difference to the variance because the variance is dominated by gene flow. What's interesting, though, is that the variance caused by linkage disequilibrium increases. So as you're getting to high levels of dispersal, you're getting lots of disequilibria because clines are starting to overlap. That's kind of interesting because it means that gene flow, where you have like effectively steep gradients, can actually introduce lots of disequilibria. A lot of the variance that populations are responding to are down to associations between alleles, really. Goodness me. So that means there's a potential for selection to act on associations between genes. So that's all well and good. What we decided perhaps rather foolishly to do was to test this in the real world. So we went out to North Queensland where we have these repeated gradients from cold rainforest down to warm sort of mesic forest along altitudinal gradients of varying length. So the repeated ecological transitions that vary in steepness. And so we can test these predictions by going out, collecting flies, setting up families, doing crosses, and testing stress resistance along these gradients. This is work I've done with Jason Kennington, amongst others at UWA. So we went out and did this, got some evidence that there is some local adaptation along some of these gradients, and not others. And now we're testing it in much more detail in an absolutely huge fly experiment, which my postdoc, Eleanor O'Brien, is working with four technicians on this project, generating thousands of crosses to try and partition the variance that's caused by gene flow and how that relates to the change in mean. So estimate this divergence in trait mean and variance along different ecological gradients of different steepnesses and ask the stabilizing selection question, so how does genetic divergence or population divergence correlate with demography? Is there this coupling effect? And then do these field experiments. This is being done with a lot of help from Mark Blows as well as Ari Hoffman. And I just want to finish just by saying, well, I think one of the key things we need to think about in terms of genetic architecture, building on these models, is saying, well, when you look at real complicated traits that interact with each other, like flower morphology, one of the key things is that genetic variance, additive variance in fitness, might not increase in the way that these models predict, and that could be really, really important. I mean, an increasing number of data sets are showing us that additive variance in fitness is actually quite limited in real populations. And any circumstances where the spread of alleles is slowed down, potentially by the steepness of gradients, by G by E interactions, there's the potential, because alleles are spreading together, for G by G to build up, for epistasis to build up, and that's the beginning of speciation, to my mind. When you start to get these narrow gradients with gene flow that generate disequilibria, you can start to get selection favouring assortative mating or favouring habitat selection. And it's this effect of selection on genotypes, rather than just positive or negative alleles, that means that LD increases and you can get selection for reduced dispersal. So I think it's where we start to think about situations where genotypes have to spread rather than alleles. And I was going to summarise that there. So basically we need to test theoretical models with data. And the key thing is that limits of adaptation generate parametric distributions. And a key question I'm trying to answer is why does adaptation stop? And I think a key issue going from p to diversity into sympatry, into alpha diversity, is understanding how LD is generated and how selection on LD might generate barriers to gene flow, accumulation of barriers to gene flow. But basically, we need to test models with empirical data. And one thing I've particularly been struck by here is that in this meeting is that transient dynamics are probably really, really important. And, you know, the rate and pattern of ecological change varies all the time. And a lot of these models require quite constant selection on very similar traits to produce speciation. But we really need to understand the genomics of traits that affect fitness if we want to predict how easy speciation is in nature. Thanks very much.
A quick question?
Yeah. Sorry, I guess it's more of a comment. That's that the... I'm sure you can answer the comment too. It's that one issue that I've always had with these models is that they assume basically either a linear, single linear dimension, or they, in principle, assume that you have continuous gene flow across the entire brain. Yeah. But it seems to me that that's never happened in nature. Instead, what tends to happen is that you have areas where you have high gene flow or not. It just has always seemed to me that there would always be some place along the range where a species would be able to, you know, move out of that constraint of gene flow and therefore proceed without limit. So I'm not sure how in real populations gene flow will ever provide a range around a constraint.
Well, that's what we're trying. I mean, I think these models, I think about them in terms of population level. So I don't think about ranges. I think about a population at the edge of its margin. So really, I mean, these gradients in these altitudinal are like 4 kilometres long. And the fly moves 50 metres per generation on average, so they're really quite short.
But the phenomenon we're trying to explain is species-wise range limits.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure the population range limits, because I say it was too accurate, I'm just not sure how they do the relevant terrain effect.
That's what we're trying to test. So the spatial scale at which gene flow and selection interact in this way, we can see that gene flow increases variance in some of our populations. So I think there is an effect there. But I don't believe that like Maya thought that the edge of a range is affected by what goes on thousands of kilometres away. I don't believe that for a second. I think it's really local limits that we're trying to talk about.
Just a quick comment. I know that we've done some work on how environmental stress and so how the environment needs to be expression of variation. And then if you think that can be playing a role in these range limits, where it's not the amount of variation, the expression of that variation.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. Yeah, so, I mean, we're only just starting to delve into that issue of how expression changes in different, looking at transcriptomes in different situations. Yeah, I mean, that could be very, especially in plants. I know that that's very important in plants. So, but I won't talk about that.